Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing, as time allows, to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice. After all, that has all been a misunderstanding. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. We continue our exposition of 2 Samuel. We're in chapter 3. We pick up with verse 31. We just had the account of Joab's wanton murder of his rival, Abner, who was his counterpart in the Saulite regime. Abner had come to make peace with David and to use his influence, for he was the functional king, not the de jure king, to turn over the whole kingdom to David. When Joab got wind of that, on a ruse, he managed to murder Abner, who was totally unsuspecting what Joab had up his sleeve. When David heard of it, he said, "I and my kingdom are innocent before the Lord forever of the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. I want everybody far and near to know that there is no complicity on my part in this evil deed." In fact, he went so far as to pronounce a curse on the head of Joab, his relative. "May it fall on the head of Joab and on all his father's house, and may there not fail from the house of Joab one who has a discharge, one who is a leper, one who takes hold of a distaff or falls by the sword, who lacks bread." That curse was just, and you can be sure that it was effective. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner. They killed him because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the Battle of Gibeon. Asahel fell in war. Joab murdered Abner in peace, and therefore the curse. Then David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, "Tear your clothes and gird on sackcloth and lament for Abner." As we were saying at the end of the last program, that must have totally humiliated Joab. King David walked behind the bier. And thus they buried Abner in Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice, and he wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king chanted a lament for Abner, and he said, "Should Abner die as a fool dies, your hands were not bound, nor your feet put in fetters. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen." And all the people wept over him. And then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was still day, For David had vowed, saying, May the Lord do so to me, and more also if I taste bread or anything, before the sun goes down. David prescribed that Abner, who came to him in peace, would be buried with honor, and not sent back to Manahim, but would be buried right there in an honorable memorial in Hebron, which was presently his capital. In that way, David made it quite clear where he stood on the matter, as well as in his public lament in verses 33 and 34, which we just read. He grieves the dishonorable death of Abner. He acknowledges that Abner was murdered by treachery, and he died as a godless fool or a common criminal might perish. David's obvious pain in his public words would have served as an open rebuke to the vile action of his general Joab. In his sorrow, David was joined by the weeping of the people as well. The occasion had Joab and Abishai hanging their heads in shame, and David's obvious admiration of Abner as a warrior, a commander, and a loyal friend to Saul must have stung Joab to the bone, and deservedly so, to hear his rival so praised before all of the people. Of course, it would be easy for cynics to dismiss all this public lament, especially in our day, as so much political show for the sake of public opinion. But David was not a disingenuous person. His grief for Abner reflected a true sense of regret and loss. David saw him, in the worldly sense, as a great and worthy man. See verse 38 on that. We'll come to that. He saw him as a man who might have been, once he transferred his political loyalties to David, an enormous asset to David's kingdom, and though it is unsaid, one who might have replaced the very difficult Joab. But this was not to be in the plan of God. We've already explained in a previous segment why it is that David did not discharge Joab. In any event, David's pain and sorrow in this whole ugly episode was no mask. It did not come off after the funeral when David retired to his royal dwelling. In fact, his grief, it was as intense as ever. So much so that David would not even eat, but he buried himself in a self-imposed fast until evening, as we just read. As his servants tried to persuade the king to nourish himself, David protested that they did not seem to grasp the gravity and the grief of the occasion. All the people took note of it. It pleased them, just as everything the king did pleased all the people. We can take that, I believe, as a generalized statement. We know from the Psalms, though it is early in David's reign, that he had his enemies, and some of them, in the court. And that was a great grief to David. But for the people in general, David was a very popular monarch, and for reasons just like these. So all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the will of the king to put Abner, the son of Ner, to death. That was Joab's doing. Then the king said to his servants, Do you not know that a prince, meaning Abner, and a great man, in the worldly sense, has fallen this day in Israel, and I am weak today, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too difficult for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil. And later on, he did just that. When the report leaked out, there was no doubt about David's feelings about Abner. This was not a PR move. David's grief over the circumstances of Abner's death were genuine, and there was no doubt, we are told in the public mind, that David was no part whatsoever of the plot to dispatch Abner, no matter what people might think or what they might say. And this record is part of God protecting the reputation of David. The popular estimate of David again soared. His actions as their king commended his spirit and wisdom to the people. He had won the battle for their hearts. Any smear or stigma that might have hung over David from his fugitive years, when Saul was publicly castigating him and running him down as a would-be usurper of the throne, all of that foul air dissipated as the public again and again observed his godly and prudent actions and his fervent protest against the evil actions of his relative and captain. Again, I tell you, the Lord has a way of protecting the reputation of his people, his godly people. When people walk in righteousness, they can be smeared, and sometimes some of that will appear to stick to the flypaper, but it's amazing how the Lord, if we put one foot in front of the other, we don't fight fire with fire, but just continue to walk through it and let people throw the mud as they will. It's amazing how we come through relatively undamaged. So here's another example of the reality that in the end, the truth will prevail. Of course, as I was just hinting, folks, there's nothing absolute about that in this transient world where lies and deceit are deeply interwoven in the fabric of human behavior. The Jewish establishment smeared up the Lord Jesus real good before he was executed, but all that went away. However, even now, in time, truth has a way of powering its way through slander and misrepresentation and making itself known. I don't think anybody could ever estimate the grief it must have been to David, as a godly man, to have been so pervasively and publicly slandered by Saul when he was alive. To be a man who was so innocent of any wrongdoing, yet to be treated and chased as an outlaw, and to suffer so much when David should have been nothing but honored. Now here, after Saul, as David settles into the regency, the people are gradually coming to another point of view. Those who may have had any misgivings about the role David played and all that are now, if previously they had any cynicism, they're coming, as we see from the text, more and more to an accurate point of view about the character of the man God is making their new king. David was not perfect. We'll know that from later narratives. He was a man. To use the old expression, he put his pants on one leg at a time like the rest of us. But he was a man of integrity. He was a man who intended to walk with God, and when it finally came home to him that he had stepped in it and walked outside the ways of the Lord, David was quick to acknowledge that and to repent. In his providence, God saw to it that the true character of David has opportunity through these events to disabuse the people of any slanders they may have bought into under Saul's regime and public pressure and slander. Sometimes we can get so frustrated in such circumstances that we actually make ourselves look bad by trying too hard to defend our honor. Now, that may be a public thing. Sometimes that may be a private thing in a home where a marriage goes bad and you've got one part of the marital equation out there. They're really wrong. They're really bad. But in order to more or less exonerate themselves in the eyes of their friends and neighbors and all of that, they go out and do a smear job on the relatively innocent party in their marriage. That's so exasperating. I've never been through it, but I've certainly seen it. And I've been a part of things like that, not that same thing. And it's just exasperating to have people out there saying these things, and there's not a word of truth to it. Sometimes they're outright lies. Sometimes they're not lies so much as they're misrepresentations of the truth. It's not what people say. It's what they leave out. It's not what they say, but it's the way you said it and the way they represent it. I've gone through all of that. My, I can so identify with the frustration that David may have had. It's never too convincing in our own defense. We get too shrill and too aggressive about disproving the lies that others tell about us. Many times, dear friends, the best advice is just to stick with business. Just keep our mouths relatively shut. Keep doing the right thing, and let God, in time, smoke out the liars and their lies. And here in David's narrative is an instance of that very thing. Now, here is another point of interest, I think. David, the text tells us, pleased the people in everything that he did. I did mention several moments ago that I believe we can best understand that in light of all of the narratives and in light of the Psalms, where David pours out his heart to God and lament and ask for relief. But that's a generalized statement. It's easy to speak of a leader and say he's very popular with the people. That doesn't mean he's popular with every single person, because we know that wasn't true with David. However, there was a general climate of approval for David in everything he did. But, note this, David was not a people pleaser in all that he did. There's a big difference. David set out to please God. It was not his agenda to please the people, though in the providence of God, he managed to do that. My dear friends, there's no future in being a people pleaser. You can't be a people pleaser and please God. But pleasing God has a wonderful way of pleasing God's people as well. I didn't say the world, but I said God's people. If it is asked, how did David manage to publicly shame, and rightly so, Joab and his brother Abishai, and not alienate them completely? Now that's a good question, but I think a significant part of the answer has to lie in David's moral authority. David, at this point in his life, just took the high ground, the moral high ground, the spiritual high ground. They knew it. They both knew they had taken the low ground. And inwardly, I believe they could not help but look up to David as a moral being much superior to themselves. Moral authority, my friends, is not to be underestimated in the leadership equation. Some historians would attribute the winning edge in some wars to one side having the moral high ground. We see that when Jesus, one lonely figure, drove the money changers out of the temple. It wasn't Rambo who did that, nor was it the fear of his small whip that sent all those guys scurrying like cockroaches. Oh no, it was nothing but his overwhelming moral authority that broke up the party. They got out of there. One lonely figure. Not Rambo either, I said. There's nothing quite like moral authority. And it was that moral authority of King David that on that day won the day. And I feel certain Joab and his brother Abishai and his men, they knew in their consciences that David was entirely right and they had been grievously wrong. Now, this brings us to chapter 4. Now, when Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, we're told that Ishbosheth lost courage. He didn't have much going for him anyway, and all Israel was disturbed. They admired Abner. And Saul's son had two men who were commanders of bands. They were kind of rogues. The name of one was Baana, and the name of the other was Rechab. They were sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite. They were the sons of Benjamin, Saul's tribe, or Beeroth, is also considered part of Benjamin. Now, Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the report of Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. His nurse on that day took him up. She fled. It happened in her hurry to flee. She fell. It wasn't a day of modern orthopedic surgery. He became lame. His name was Mephibosheth. So the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, Rechab and Baana, they departed, and they came to the house of Ishbosheth in the heat of the day while he was unsuspecting and taking his midday rest, as I paraphrase slightly. They came to the middle of the house as if to get wheat. At that point, they struck him in the belly, and those two escaped. And when they came into the house as he was lying on the bed in his bedroom, they struck him and killed him. At that time, they also beheaded him. And they took his head, and they traveled all the way up the Arabah all night. They brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron, and they thought that was going to please David. So here they presented it like a trophy of war. In verse 9, David answered those two, and he said, "As the Lord lives, who redeemed my life from all distress, when previously one told me, 'Behold, Saul is dead,' and thought he was bringing me good news, I seized him and killed him in Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. And how much more, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house and his own bed, shall I now require his blood from your hand and destroy you from the earth?" And David immediately ordered their execution. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and they buried it in the grave of Abner in Hebron. Well, as the narrative chronicling the rising power of David and the goodwill toward him in Judah continues, we see in the demise of Abner, who was the real pillar who sustained the legitimate but pathetic heir to the throne of Saul for 7 years. We see the roof caving in, and the vultures are circling, Things are coming to a head as far as a rival to David's throne and legitimacy as heir to Saul's throne are concerned. Now, as I've said, our sovereign God will fulfill his promises. God will carry out his plan and purpose. But from the human perspective, things can be a little messy. Never forget that. The outworking of God's plan seldom runs on a straight line, that is, to our vision. And sometimes God's plan seldom runs in timelines that we might have assumed or expected. David has reigned over Judah for better than 7 years now. But the other 11 tribes, though they have agreed with Abner's earlier appeal to make a move to unite with Judah, Ishbosheth, feeble as he is still officially their king, and all of that was about to change. Now, this was God's work. This was God's providence, but it was not God's sin. God is not temptable, neither does he tempt, James tells us in his epistle. There was sin involved in bringing it to pass. God does use, as I've said a zillion times, God does use the inclinations of evil men and ill-motivated persons to accomplish unwittingly his purposes. He did that in nations, and he does that in churches. People do wicked things. God does not cause bad people to do bad things in our churches. Nevertheless, when God wants to accomplish something, his secret will, he allows them. When the report of Abner's death broke and filtered back to the royal residence of Ishbosheth at Mahanaim, and filtered out to the rest of the northern tribes, it broke whatever remained of the spirit of Ishbosheth. The game was over. He knew it. Abner was a crutch that Ishbosheth leaned on for support. At that time, he just gave up. He lost courage. Literally, in the Hebrew language, it says his hands dropped. Helpless and executive paralysis came all over Ishbosheth like a blanket. Not only was he dispirited by the news, but we read that all Israel was disturbed when the one leader who had stood between them and despair was lost. In their titular king, they obviously had no confidence. It's easy to find people willing to fill an office, folks, but fewer carry the weight that belongs to an office, whatever it is. Though there was a man on the throne of Saul, in effect, there was a power vacuum at the top, and there definitely was once Abner was out of the picture. And when the perception exists that a king, figuratively or real, is in a weak position, one can be sure intrigue is not far behind. And so it is in this case. People wait around for leaders. There are always envious people, jealous people, ambitious people. Anytime there's a leadership equation, whether it's in the nation, whether it's in the state, whether it's in the county, or whether it's in the mayor's office, whether it's in the business or the military or the church, human nature is such that whenever there is a power vacuum or whenever leadership is in a weak position, you can count on it. Intrigue is not far behind, and there will be subversives. And in some cases, there will be attempted or real assassinations. One can see why political leaders from the earliest times have always looked askance at their military. For more than anyone else, it is the army in political situations that's in best position to stage a coup or an assassination of any leader they may want to get rid of. And so in this case, there were in Ishbosheth's remaining forces two rogue leaders of military units. They knew they had no future unless somehow they could ingratiate themselves with the new regime. That was David's. So they took upon themselves a plan to execute an assassination plot. And that is going to be their undoing. And again, we see the prudence of David in taking these guys down. Well, friends, our time has expired. We'll come back to this in our next study. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach. Be sure.